From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Americans are living longer, but are, as a whole, sicker. America spends far more on health care per person than any other high-income country, yet lags behind on a range of health indicators. Preventable chronic diseases and behavioral issues, including opioid addiction, are on the rise across all populations, but the most disadvantaged communities are disproportionately affected. Improving economic prosperity is among the priorities announced by the nation's doctor when he was confirmed. Yesterday, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams outlined a community-based initiative to a group at the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. It's not something we might expect from a Surgeon General. I spoke with Dr. Adams before that event. I asked him, what is the connection between the economy and physical health?
Well, we know that when businesses invest in health, they see returns in terms of absenteeism, in terms of productivity, in terms of being able to attract talented workforces across the board. And what I'm trying to do is translate our health programs and health metrics into a language that resonates with both voters and policymakers. We know that the number one issue people vote on across the country pretty consistently is jobs and the economy. And so I want folks to understand that if you want higher wages, if you want more jobs in your community, if you want healthy consumers buying your products, then you need to care about the fact that America is spending more on health care than any other country and is not getting the results that we should be getting, is not getting the return on investment.
So who are you working with to make this happen?
We're working with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We're working with the Federal Reserve. We're working with major businesses like Dow Chemical. We're proud of the work that Target and IBM are doing. There are lots of folks out there who are starting to see that so much of health is not just healthcare. As a matter of fact, studies show that about 90% of health is not healthcare, but is the environment that we live in, is the behaviors that we engage in throughout the day, and that there are things that businesses and communities can do to nudge those behaviors in a positive direction by putting better choices in front of individuals.
Well, you've made these kind of partnerships sort of a hallmark, I think, of your tenure, getting people together, working in the business community, healthcare professionals, nonprofits, decision makers. Give us an idea of a concrete model. Where are you seeing that working, those kind of partnerships?
In Richmond, Indiana, the second lady, Mrs. Pence, and I visited Belden, and it's an example around the opioid epidemic, which is really forcing people to take a hard look at community health. They had to interview over 200 people to fill just a couple of jobs because so many people failed the drug test. Mm-hmm. And what they decided to do was to start testing people up front. And if people either said they needed help or tested positive, instead of not hiring them and not telling them, they offer them treatment. And those folks, if they successfully complete treatment, then have a job available on the back end. That's an example of a business taking an innovative approach to community health and wellness.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis, because you came out of the gate with a three-pronged approach to treating opioid crisis, normalizing naloxone, that can be called Narcan or Evzio, which helps revive many people who have overdosed. And a second change, is more difficult. It's a behavioral shift. It's changing how we talk about and think about addiction. What kind of changes do you want to see?
One of the things that I want to do is help folks understand that addiction is a chronic disease. Yes, there are bad choices that are often made that lead to addiction, but you can't make a good choice if literally your brain is not functioning properly. And we know from looking at the scans that your brain changes when you're under the influence of drugs, of alcohol, of other substances. We also know that unfortunately, a lot of us played a part and folks going down the pathway to addiction. My own brother, as many people know, is in prison right now. He committed crimes to support his addiction, and his addiction started with a pill that he was given at a party. 4 out of 5 heroin users got started with a prescription opioid, usually from someone else's medicine cabinet. So one of the things that's important for your listeners to know, particularly around the holidays, is that they have a very real potential to be someone else's first drug dealer because of unsecured and undisposed of opioids that are often left lying around.
So addiction is a chronic disease that must be treated in the same way hypertension or diabetes might be treated. But how do you change minds about that? There is still, I think, a lot of moralism and a lot of judgment around addiction.
I think one of the ways you change minds is by sharing stories. I don't like sharing with the world the story about my brother, but the more I do it, the more people come forward to me and say, you know, that's also happening to my family. I can relate. And once we start to see it not as us and them, the good guys and the bad guys, but of everyone being affected, I think that helps to change people's minds. I think we also have to show stories of recovery. Unfortunately, and I was talking with Robert just a few days ago, who is now a recovery counselor but used to be addicted to heroin, and Robert will tell you that we're just inundating people with bad news, with terrible statistics, with deaths and overdoses, and folks start to get hardened to that. But the more we share those stories of recovery, stories such as Robert's story, such as Jonathan's story, who is now a peer recovery coach after being revived with naloxone, the more folks will start to recognize this as a disease that can be treated and not a moral failing that we can arrest our way out of.
The third focus that you announced was on prevention. So where does treatment actually come into this?
Well, treatment is a very important part of it. I lift up naloxone, but that's just the first step. We don't want to just revive someone over and over again and not provide them a bridge to treatment. And so the federal government has increased the number of medication-assisted treatment providers. We're working with groups such as Project Echo to try to increase telemedicine access to treatment services. And we need to rethink the way that we deliver treatment. There simply is never going to be enough addiction providers to meet the need in the traditional inpatients, everyone see a psychiatrist sense. We need to bring all of our providers to the forefront and have them armed to be able to provide treatment both outpatient and inpatient. And we're starting to see success. You know, it took over 20 years for us to get to where we are, and we're not going to dig our way out of this hole in just 2 years. But we are slowly starting to see progress. We're starting to see minds change. We're starting to see stigma become less and less. And I'm confident that we will put out this fire. But what I want to make sure we do is use this opportunity to also prevent the next fire from occurring by educating the public.
Well, one of the things that your office has done and that you've announced is really important to you as a doctor, as a scientist, is to use evidence-based information when communicating health outcomes and dangers. And you're working in an administration that's been accused by the Union of Concerned Scientists, among others, with sidelining evidence-based data. And we've seen orders from the EPA, the Department of the Interior, agencies restricting the use of data. Have you found your priorities to be at all in conflict with the administration?
The most honest answer I can give you is I have never in my year and a half in office felt that I couldn't go out there and speak to the science that I was being muzzled in any way, shape, or form. As a matter of fact, folks have continually prodded me to make sure I'm out there preaching the science, particularly about opioids and addiction.
In addition to preaching about evidence-based science, one of the things that, again, I want to return to this idea of partnerships, you were speaking in front of a group of police leaders in Boston recently, and you talked about local control, local innovation. That's what I'm all about. In Massachusetts, for example, they have programs that allow addicts to turn in drugs at the police station without fear of arrest. So when you're looking at making big changes like this across the country, what do you think? I mean, would something like that work in Georgia?
Well, one of the things that we want to do is both allow local control, but also evaluate these programs. We want to make sure when these experiments are happening naturally across the country that we're carefully looking at whether or not we are truly getting the outcomes that we desire and whether the benefits outweigh the risk. And that's why the CDC, which is right here in Atlanta, is so important. That's why it's important that we work with academic partners to be able to say, yes, if you do X, you will get Y. But it's also important to understand that just because something works in Boston, Massachusetts, doesn't mean it's going to work in Atlanta, Georgia, or Dallas, Texas.
Well, also in Boston, you talked about federal drug classifications needing to be revised, and a number of news organizations really seized upon that. You know, the Surgeon General says we should reclassify marijuana, now Schedule 1 drug, like heroin and LSD. Is that true? Could we want to clarify that statement?
Absolutely. That was mischaracterized. It was a conversation that was asking about the classification schedule, and my statement was that we need to make sure we are making it as easy as possible for folks to do research on marijuana in particular, not that we need to reclassify marijuana. Certainly, I don't support that, but I do think that we need to evaluate everything that we do. And as folks are out there implementing marijuana policy across the country with little to no evidence in many cases, I think one of the things we need to try to do as a federal government is to make sure we are facilitating research so that these policy solutions can be influenced and led by, where possible, the scientific information.
Well, the science is one thing, the behavior is another. As you said, in 2017, the CDC reported 80,000 Americans died from influenza. This was the highest number in decades. 180 of them children, 80% of those not vaccinated. So what are your hopes for establishing effective community health initiatives, partnerships with businesses, if even basics like vaccination are not penetrating the population or changing behavior?
Flu is a great example. The flu is estimated to cost every county across America $1 to $2 million every year in lost productivity and in health care costs. And so we need to help folks understand that, yes, it is a personal decision as to whether or not you get a flu shot, but it's a personal decision that has implications that are much greater than whether or not you get the flu. Your grandmother, your newborn niece or nephew, someone else's newborn niece or nephew in the community may die because you passed along the flu, even if you never felt a symptom in the first place. The community may not be able to experience wage growth or job growth because they're spending so much money treating the negative outcomes of the flu that you spread. The more that we can show that we are all in this together and that it's not just simply about a single decision in an individual's health, but it's about the overall physical, mental, and financial health of communities and of our entire country, the more I think we'll be able to get people on board. At least that's what I hope for, and that's the way I'm looking at some of these difficult problems across the country. And it's the way that I've seen have success, particularly in my time in Indiana, bringing folks together, showing them that a common cause can lead to better partnerships.
Well, Dr. Adams, it's great to have you back in Atlanta. And I know on a previous flight to Atlanta, you had a pretty eventful time. Anything happened this time?
Fortunately, nothing happened this time. For your listeners' information, I was on a Delta flight and had to respond to an individual who was having trouble, health problems on that flight. And I was very, very glad to be able to step up and provide those services. And the individual actually ended up doing okay.
I can only imagine when the Delta flight attendant called, "Is there a doctor in the house?" She may not have expected the Surgeon General to be there.
No, they were a little shocked.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia. Have a wonderful day. And get your flu shot if you haven't, and encourage everyone around you to do the same.
U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, he was in Atlanta speaking to a group at the Federal Reserve Bank yesterday, and he encouraged us to check in with him about the development of the partnerships that he was talking about. We'll definitely do that. Stay with us for a conversation about black farmers, increasing the rare in the United States. What kind of barriers do they face? We'll speak with an author of a book about the subject after the break, when On Second Thought continues.